I'd like to call the meeting of the January 17th hearing of the Government Operations Committee to order. Thank you all for being here today. Let the record, Representative Lilly has checked in, but I believe he just stepped out momentarily, so let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. First order of business is the approval of minutes from the January 17th meeting of the Government Operations Committee. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'll approve the make a motion that we approve those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we have approved the minutes. The agenda actually says that the Commission on Pensions will be coming first. I don't think we need to. However, I think we can probably take the bill up first so we don't keep Representative Poston waiting through the whole committee. Thank you, Representative Poston. Welcome to the committee. Glad to have you here. I will, before you begin your testimony, I will move that House File 33 be considered for re-referral to the Ways and Means Committee. And if you could just please identify yourself and your, as well as your guest when you start speaking for the record, that would be great.
Perfect. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. I'm Representative John Poston from District 9A. And I'm here to present House File 33, and along with me from Sourcewell is Dan Lustig, or Lustig, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Okay. House File 33 adds service cooperatives to the definition of governmental units for purposes of joint powers. Service cooperatives are made up of governmental units as defined in the Joint Powers Act. Governmental units include cities, counties, townships, school districts, and we hope now service cooperatives, as well as some other entities. A little bit about Sourcewell, which is the service cooperative up in my neck of the woods. Sourcewell has 50,000 members. They do $3.5 billion worth of contract sales out of Little Staples, Minnesota, up in north central Minnesota, and they do contracts in 47 states and in Canada. And the great thing about having them in our community up there is a lot of the money that they make on those contracts, well, all of the money they make on those contracts comes back to Minnesota, but a great deal of it goes into support activities in our communities, like schools, schools, education. They've opened a food shelf or been a partner in a food shelf. They support law enforcement and many other philanthropic activities, I guess almost is what I would call it, up in my neck of the woods. And the other cooperatives in the state, I believe, do the same. I hope you have one in your area that you're able to work with. With that, I'll hand it over to Dan.
Thank you, and if you could please just identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Dan Lustig with Sourcewell. As Representative Post noted, Sourcewell is the service cooperative covering north central Minnesota, and we're located in Staples. On behalf of Minnesota's nine service cooperatives, thank you for your consideration of House File 33 this morning. I also like to take the opportunity to thank the legislature for passing and including this bill in the supplemental budget bill last year that did not become law. We're back again seeking your support for the bill. As Representative noted in his introduction, Representative Post noted in his introduction, this bill would clarify that service cooperatives are included in the definition of government unit for purposes of the Joint Power Statute 47159. There are nine service cooperatives that cover the entire state, so again, to build on Representative Poston's comments, hopefully you know who your service cooperative is and have a positive relationship with them. Service cooperatives were created by the legislature in the late 1970s to provide programs and services to government and education using collaborative and cooperative service delivery models. Under our enabling statute, we're given broad latitude in the types of programs and services we can offer at the direction of our membership. And to give you some context to what those programs look like, some common examples include education curriculum and teacher professional development, trainings and certification courses for law enforcement officials, city and county officials, contracted services like planning and zoning, child care, licensure, and other human service-related functions, cooperative purchasing services, as Representative Poston noted, and shared service or shared time arrangements. The purpose of House File 33 is to simply provide clarity to our members that service cooperatives are eligible to utilize the tool of joint powers agreements. Because service cooperatives are not explicitly listed in 471.59 currently, and because we have been using the existing established framework of joint powers agreements, we're seeking this clarification before you hear today in the bill. We believe that this bill will provide clarity to allow us to better deliver on our statutory mission, which is to serve government and education across Minnesota. We do not believe that the bill negatively impacts any group currently defined in the law, and through three committee hearings last session, there was no opposition testimony offered. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, again, thank you for your consideration of House File 33, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions you may have.
Sure. Are there any questions from members? Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more of a comment than a question, but this was a good bill last year. It's unfortunate it got caught up in the mess at the end, but I think this is a good bill and we should pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I agree. Hope all bills can be this bright and happy. Representative Poston, do you have any closing remarks or anything?
Well, I just thank you for getting us on your schedule so early in the committee process. We really appreciate that, and we appreciate the time you've given us this morning and would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Post.
Have a good day.
Yep, you too. So the motion is to re-refer this to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep, thank you. So the next item of business is I've asked the Pension Commission to come here and to just give a presentation. A lot of what we do in this, there will be a fair amount of discussion of related to pensions in this committee. So let's see, who do we have? Yes, if you could please come down.
Good morning.
Good morning. If you could please identify yourself for the record. I was excited to learn I was just appointed for the first time to the Pension Commission, so I look forward to seeing a lot of you in the coming session.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Yes, we did get notice on Friday afternoon, and there are at least a couple of members here who are on the Pension Commission, so yourself and Representative Nelson, I believe. My name is Susan Lincheski. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. With me is Chad Burkett, who is our new analyst. About 3 or 4 months ago, Rachel Barth, who you all may have met, she was our Deputy Director. She is now over with the Teachers Retirement Association. Chad was with MSRS, one of the plans that we oversee. He is now with the Pension Commission, and we're very happy to have him. He started a couple weeks ago. We prepared a PowerPoint, which I believe was distributed to all of you. I'll go through that quickly, sharing some of the slides with Chad, who will help go through this. First off, the commission was established in the 1960s as a permanent permanent commission to provide for bipartisan, bicameral review of pension and retirement issues, including legislation. So the commission hears legislation that relates to retirement generally, and also, of course, most importantly, to the public pension plans that cover public employees across the state. The commission consists of 14 legislators, 7 from the House, 7 from the Senate. The statute limits the number from the majority party from each house to 5. So we've had, last session, we had 5 and 2 from the Senate and 5 and 2 from the House with the Republicans in the majority there in both houses. The executive committee is the chair, the vice chair, and the secretary. We hope that we will have all three of those at our first meeting of the commission. the staff of the commission, myself, Chad, and we also have a commission assistant, Lisa Dieselin. I've been around for about 4 years, Lisa much longer, about 18 years, I believe, and Chad just recently. We provide drafting services, so we will do some bill drafting for legislators and commission members. We also work with our actuary, which this last five-year period has been Deloitte. Deloitte helps with review of the actuarial reports that are being provided by the plans every year, together with experience studies. The commission office is in the ground floor of the state office building. We have a website that has lots of information on it. If you ever want to take a look at the plans, actuarial reports, they are available there. At the end, towards the end of the PowerPoint, I have a screenshot of our page, and there is a lot of information available at the drop-downs on that page. Moving on to slide four. The commission meets weekly during the session. We meet a little less frequently during the interim. Mostly in the fall, there will be at least a couple meetings. So this fall, I would expect that we will have some meetings of the commission. As I mentioned, we propose legislation, review it, take testimony. We also monitor the actuarial reports of the plans, and then just generally study retirement topics. So, for instance, occasionally some topics such as Social Security impacts on pensions, as well as some of the other topics. Not recalling those right now, but defined contribution plans. So there's been some interest in looking at those in case that's something that should be used by the by public employers as a supplement or in some cases even a replacement for our pension plans. Last session, the commission staff prepared 19 bills, 27 amendments, 8 background memos, and summaries of 6 iterations of the omnibus bill. If you recall, in the 2018 session, the Pension Commission produced a 245-page omnibus bill, which included appropriations for the agencies and the government entities, such as school districts, that were going to have to pay a little bit additional as employer contributions. We had five meetings during the interim and then 4 meetings during the session.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Again, I'm Chad Burkett, analyst for the LCPR. This next section is going to cover pensions in Minnesota, just a high-level overview. So the LCPR provides legislative oversight for 3 statewide pensions that cover all the public employees in Minnesota at the state, local, and local level. The 3 funds are the Minnesota State Retirement System, the Public Employees Retirement Association, and the Teachers Retirement Association. The Minnesota State Retirement System covers state employees. They actually administer 5 pension plans, 5 defined benefit pension plans, and 2 defined contribution plans. The Public Employees Retirement Association covers county and municipal employees and other local employees, and the Teachers Retirement Association covers K through 12 teachers, administrators, and also Minnesota State, some faculty there. The LCPR also provides some oversight for some other local plans throughout the state, notably the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association, which provides pension benefits for teachers and administrators in the City of St. Paul School District. And then we have 610 independent volunteer firefighter relief associations around the state. So moving on to the next slide 7. These are just some facts that we think are important for any policy discussion about pensions. So, again, just pretty high level. So employees and employers in Minnesota contribute to pension funds. Most pension benefits are paid out as monthly lifetime annuities. I think people kind of intuitively grasp that. Pension eligibility benefits and contributions are defined in statute, which is a little bit different than a lot of other states, at least for the contribution rates. And then each fund, MSRS Para TRA, St. Paul Teachers, They have their own governing board and executive director, and so I'm sure you'll all be hearing from them. And then the board members and executive directors are fiduciaries for their fund. Pension assets in each of these funds, that especially something to consider for the statewide funds, they can't be intermingled with other state funds, and they're there for the exclusive benefit of their plan members. Investment assets for these pension plans for the three statewide pension funds, they're all invested by the State Board of Investment. The State Board and the directors are fiduciaries there. The SBI consists of the constitutional officers minus the lieutenant governor, so the governor, state auditor, secretary of state, and attorney general. Most of the investment decisions are made by the staff there with a consultation from the Investment Advisory Council, which consists of 10 members of the public, I believe, are selected for their expertise in investments. The three executive directors of the pension funds, the MMB commissioner, and then one representative from an employee group. And then as of June 30th of 2018, the market value of all SBI invested assets was $96.2 billion, of which 82% are public retirement fund assets. So most of that money is pension funds that are invested. And those funds are invested in a separate pool from other funds that SBI invests.
Moving on to slide 9, I'll just mention some highlights from the legislation in 2018. It did approve a number, or it included a number of benefit reforms, including elimination of something called augmentation, which is COLAs on deferred vested benefits, so people who left the state were continuing to get their benefit augmented or increased by a certain specific percentage, 2% in the case of MSRS and TRA every year. That benefit was eliminated in the bill, together with some changes to COLAs. So primarily the intent here was to try to stabilize the plan's financial situation, the funding of the plan, the funded status. And COLAs are a big way to do that. By freezing COLAs or reducing COLAs slightly, you can save millions in our very large public pension plans. The bill also increased contributions, as I mentioned previously, so most of the plans received an increase in their employer contributions, and in some cases employee contributions went up. This was especially the case in the public safety funds, so the pension plans that are covering our public safety employees, employer and employee contributions went up for this year and for future years, so there's a phase in on those. One of the other important aspects of the bill was to reduce the assumption relating to the investment rate of return, and that always gets a lot of discussion. It had been at 8% for all the plans except teachers. Teachers was at 8.5%. The bill reduced it for all the plans down to 7.5%, which was based on the testimony of experts and our State Board of Investment director. In addition, the bill provided for appropriations. I'd mentioned that earlier. There are some additional state aids, so those are direct cash infusions to a couple of our plans. And in addition, then because the contributions were increased, there were appropriations to help the agencies and school districts deal with those increases. As I mentioned, slide 10 is a screenshot of our website. We provide some news relating to our bill and our commission. We also provide some Minnesota news. So things that come out in the press that relate to our pension plans are going to be provided here. We try to provide a link. And then sometimes, occasionally, national news. Minnesota will show up in the national news, and we pick those up as well. And as I mentioned, the drop-down that says Minnesota pension plan information is where you can find the actuarial reports. And that will give you a very detailed assessment of where each of our pension plans stands by way of funded status, contribution sufficiency or deficiency, and lots of information about the assumptions used in valuing those plans. The final page is just our contact information. We also have a Twitter feed. Try to provide some information there as well if you follow us on Twitter. That's all I have.
Yep. Thank you, Ms. Lencheski. Go to member questions here. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just tell me a little bit? I didn't know about this volunteer firefighter pension thing. Can you tell me about that? I'm interested in like where the money comes from for that and how that works. Thanks.
Ms. Lencheski.
Yes, thank you, Chair Freiberg. Representative, there is a source of funding for those plans. So across the state we have, as I mentioned in the PowerPoint, about 600 of these tiny little pension plans. In some cases, they're fairly good-sized plans that provide pension benefits for our volunteer firefighters. Volunteer doesn't necessarily mean that they work free of, work without any consideration. They do get, paid on call and sometimes paid per hour compensation. So there's a pension plan set up for these that they actually established themselves, each of the relief associations. It's funded by something they refer to as the 2% source of funding. So it's a portion of the premium paid by homeowners and companies in their district for fire insurance. So it's sent into the Department of Revenue, I believe, which gets some reports about whether the plans have done their filings from the state auditor. Those go over to the Department of Revenue, and then the Department of Revenue allocates the 2% money out to each of the relief associations. In addition to these little standalone plans, there also is a statewide relief association, a statewide volunteer firefighter plan that is administered by PARA. And this was established several years ago. The goal was to eventually have all of these little standalones move into the PARA plan, where they would be centrally administered. They do have their own benefit formulas, but they are administered by PARA, so there's a little less work to do, I think, on the part of the relief associations. So that's our kind of volunteer firefighter retirement system.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the case of that centralized benefit plan that you talked about that's administered by PARA, is the funding source then the same thing? It's the 2% portion of the premium paid on fire insurance in the
Ms. Lencheski.
Yes, Chair, Representative, that is true. It comes from the same source. It goes directly over to the PARA statewide plan with respect to each of the groups that are groups of firefighters that are in that plan.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Lencheski. For the new people here, why was it so important to lower the rate of assumption? What effect does that have when you look at the plan and when you lower the assumed rate of return? Does it make the plan look better or worse? And what is the benefit of that over the long term?
Ms. Lencheski.
Chair Freiberg, Representative Nelson. As you know, when you lower the rate of return, it makes the plans look worse in terms of their funded status. So liabilities go up when you lower the assumption. So we went from 8% to 7.5%. That was a negative for our plans. So hence, they came in with proposals to change the funding primarily, but also to modify some benefits, including COLAs.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, if we didn't do that, what long-term effect? What could have happened by not lowering that? I know it in the short term it makes them look worse, but actually, what does it do in the long run?
Ms. Lencheski.
Chair Freiberg, Representative Nelson. In the long term, I think it gives us a little more accurate picture of how the plans are paying off their unfunded liabilities. So, they look out over 30 years. If we use an assumption that is closer to what we understand from the experts is likely to be achieved, it gives a better picture of how we're actually paying down those liabilities. So I think in this case, we had quite a bit of testimony. We were able to come up with a consensus on this particular percentage based on what the plan's actuaries as well were talking about. And it just gives us, I think, a better sense of how we're doing over the long term in terms of amortizing the liabilities.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, and as was, I'm asking these questions because they say a lawyer doesn't ask questions. I'm not a lawyer, but you don't ask the question you don't know the answer to. But when we have a higher assumed rate of return and we don't get that, it actually masks the need for those pension plans. It can be a big wallop if the, if something big happens that all of a sudden we're not making that, and we have a large outlay we have to make to all these retirees, and the money may not be there. So by lowering that, it actually, in the long run, is better, as a better benefit for the plans and makes them more stable.
Yeah. Representative Nelson, it's always possible to become a lawyer, and I think you'd do great at it. Did you have any follow-up to that, Ms. Lencheski?
No, Chair Freiberg, Representative Nelson is exactly correct. Yes, I think it just gives us a much better picture of where they're going based on what we think the returns will be from the investments.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lencheski, you know, as I followed the reforms that we made last year and the bill that we passed, my instincts with what I saw from the rating agencies were kind of mixed. I think they were really happy that we did what we did, and we were fortunate because we kept our bond rating. But I've also, from my perspective, read into it that we're not done yet. Curious if that might be your perception as well, that they were happy we did it, we needed to do it, but we have more work to do.
Ms. Lencheski.
Yes, Chair Freiberg, thank you, Representative Vogel. Yes, I believe that is the message that we received from the rating agencies. They kind of went back and forth. So initially, after the bill passed, they were all very happy about it, S&P, Fitch, Moody's. Then there was a stretch, I don't know, 6 weeks later or so, when they sort of backed off that and decided that we were going to actually get hit with a lower bond rating. And then they came back around sort of late summer, August, September, again, saying that Minnesota had done a great job with its pension bill. I think the problem that Minnesota has is that the way our contributions are established in statute, which is to say it's a set rate. Every employer needs to contribute a certain percentage of payroll, makes the state not able to be flexible about how it deals with underfunding our pension plans. So right now our plans are on a trajectory to get to 100% funded status, but are even 90%, which is sort of, I think, the goal. We're not there. So the plans are still, even with all of the changes that we did, none of them, I believe, except the paracorrectional is over 90%. Everything is in sort of the 60, 70% range. So I think there was some concern expressed about the way we have fixed contribution rates in the statute, which does not allow us, say, in a bad year then, investment year, to respond to that and increase contributions slightly to help out with the situation.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, maybe if you could, I'm not sure if everybody understands the difference between the statutory rate that is set in our statutes and how some other pension funds may set that rate of return relative to Chair Nelson's comments about the, you know, it hurts us when we drop the rate, but the other part of that is being realistic. So other states, how they might do it relative to our statutory setting of the rate.
Ms. Lencheski.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg, Representative Vogel. So there's a term in the pension plan world, the ARC, or the actuarial required contribution. That's something that the actuaries calculate. So every year we hear from the actuaries what they believe is required to keep our plans funded on a path that will get us to where we want to be, say 90% in 30 years. The ARC is not the contribution that is in the statute. So as we were mentioning, some years the ARC may require a greater contribution, in other years possibly less of a contribution. But our statutes require a certain level, no flexibility on that. We're in the minority. I'm not sure if there's even 10 other states that are where we are in terms of a fixed statutory rate. So that is the difference.
Representative Vogel.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. More by way of comment than a question, is the concern I have with the way we do this is that to some extent we're setting a target rather than a realistic assumption. And that forces then State Board of Investment to look at what we want to earn, 7.5 right now, which may or may not be realistic relative to the risk that we're also willing to take. And, you know, risk, I've learned, running a small bank doesn't really come to fruition until you have an economic collapse like we did in the Great Recession. And all of a sudden, the risk that I thought was okay became much more severe. So the reason for the question and the follow-up comment is I think it's a matter of discussion going forward. It's really going to be important for us to look at how are we setting or how is that rate set? And do we want to continue doing it statutorily, or do we want to maybe be more consistent? Because we do have these fluctuations with the rating agencies. And if indeed we run into problems with the pension stability, and we're also in an economic downturn, it could really significantly affect our state's bond rating. So I know it wasn't a question, but more so of a comment relative to what we're doing here and maybe fruit for another discussion sometime. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Did you have any comment to that point, Ms. Lincheski?
No, Chair Freiberg. Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What percentage are our major pensions funded at right now?
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Representative, you know, I actually have a handout on that. If I don't know if this is permitted, but
sure.
If you want to,
yeah, if our if you could hand it to the page, she'll make sure it gets distributed to members.
In anticipation of that question, we went through yes. The actuarial reports are all sent over to us. I think we received our first in early December. They all relate to June 30th of the prior fiscal year, so they are as of June 30th of 2018, or as it indicates on the chart here, July 1 of 2018. This shows where the plans are in their as to their funded status. Taking into account the changes that were in the 2018 pension bill, as well as the increased contributions, these lay out all of our plans. The MSRS General, Parageneral, and TRA are three really big plans, and then the others are the smaller St. Paul teachers, and then the public safety plans. The second column is the funded ratio as of July 1, 2018. The third column is something that's referred to as the contribution sufficiency or deficiency. And this looks at the dollars going into the plan as compared to what is necessary to fund the accrual for 1 year, also known as the normal cost. So the difference between what's going in for a year versus liabilities for a year will result in a contribution sufficiency, which is to say there's more going in than liabilities accrued, or a deficiency. And the goal is, of course, to be at a sufficiency. Most of our, well, I guess it's about a 50-50 split here. Some plans are at a sufficiency as of that date, others are not. And then the final column we put in here just to show what the state is contributing as direct cash infusions into the plans. This is separate from the appropriations going to the agencies and the school districts. These are, in some cases, a result of mergers. So, for instance, when Duluth was merged into teachers' retirement, this is the Duluth teachers, there was an underfunding that was then covered off by the plan with some by the state with some direct state aids.
Representative Elkins?
That's fine. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There any additional? Representative Gomez?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincheski, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the kind of investment scheme for these different pensions. What type of investments are they in?
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Freiberg, Representative Gomez. The State Board of Investment invests all of the assets. So they have a funding policy that is established by their Investment Advisory Council, which, as we mentioned earlier, consists mostly of experts from the industry. They've determined how we're going to allocate, how the executive director and his staff will invest the funds. So most of it is in stock, as you would imagine. I think a majority is in stock. We've got bonds, and then we have another category called other investments. which can be real estate, limited partnerships, those sorts of things that aren't quite as liquid, but actually have been performing a little better than some of the other asset classes. So it is a nice system in that we've got a kind of an advisory council that's a team of experts, and they then advise the State Board of Investment, which is our constitutional officers. So it's all over there. It's about, I think I usually think of it as about $80 billion, I believe, now in pension plan assets. And that ebbs and flows as the market, as the market does.
Representative Gomez?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincheski. So are there any, ethical standards applied to the decisions that are made around the investments at the State Board, or are we simply looking at ROI, or are there other considerations that board takes into account?
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Freiberg, Representative Gomez. So I'm speaking a little bit out of my zone of expertise, and I think the executive director for SBI was in the audience, but primarily they focus on return. So they have a funding policy that does have a section of it that talks about so-called ESG, or investing for social purposes, or to encourage companies to do things that are determined to be good for the environment, or good governance. So there is some focus on that, I believe, but primarily the interest, and this is really driven by fiduciary duty, is to maximize return for the beneficiaries of the trust.
Representative Gomez?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lincheski, I guess I'm interested in a little bit more information about that, and I don't know what form that might take, but I would love to know, said that there's this ESG.
Yep.
Kind of standard, but it would be great to know more about how many dollars are impacted by that. What's the sort of mix that we're looking at?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you said, Ms. Lincheski, that the SBI director is here, or okay. Yeah, I guess we have some time. I know we're supposed to be in session at 11:30, so I'm hoping to certainly no later than 11:15 be done here. But certainly we have some time here, so. You could come forward and identify yourself for the record, and just please provide some commentary.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mansko Puri. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for the State Board of Investment. With regard to your question, on our website, you'll find our annual report, which we do annually, which gives a pretty good summary of what our activities have been during the course of the prior year. Very early in the annual report, you'll see our statement of investment beliefs, which are a guideline as to how we invest. One of the investment beliefs that we have are that we will take into consideration environmental, social, and governance policies. First and foremost, based on our fiduciary responsibility outlined in Section 356A, we do have to look at the return that we're required for the variety of entities that we manage money for, pension plans being the biggest. In that regard, we do take into consideration these non-investment, well, I'll say that they are investment factors, that when we go about developing our asset allocation and the manager selection that we have. But first and foremost, our fiduciary responsibility causes us to pay exceptional degree on the investment return that we're there to provide for participants of the pension plans and the other entities that we manage assets for.
Representative Gomez?
Thank you. I'll check out that report. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry to call you down here. I wasn't expecting to.
It's the problem one gets when he sticks around.
Representative Salk.
Mr. Chair, I was curious if you can just share how long the board has been adopting this kind of paradigm. It's, you know, it hasn't been 50 years. I'm sure it's been like more like 10 or 20 or something like that, where you have these this change toward maybe more socially influenced investment concerns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, with regard to that specifically, we adopted our statement of investment beliefs 2 years ago. The primary reason for that was to give people a sense of how we go about investing, the fact that part of our consideration is that we take in a variety of factors. There are times when we are, I wouldn't say that we are social investors, although there have been instances when we have taken in non-investment factors in development of some of our policies, the longest being our the prohibition to invest in alcohol and tobacco companies, which we restrict our active domestic equity managers from investing in. Unfortunately, the difficulty we do have some of these divestment advocacies, such as the one that I just outlined, they have hurt returns, which does cause some difficulty for people like me who take our fiduciary responsibility pretty strongly, recognizing that the primary reason that we are there are to earn the best return within certain risk parameters for the participants whose dollars we are investing.
Representative South?
Thank you. Exactly on point. The other question is sort of a softball, and I do it tongue-in-cheek, having a wife who grew up in Chicago. And I know that some states do look on their pension funds as a solution for maybe short-term or long-term cash flow challenges. Has that ever occurred in Minnesota's history?
Mr. Chairman, members, I've been associated on and off with the funds from 1990. I was a member of the staff from 1990 to 2008 when I left to go work for two other organizations before coming back 5 years ago. And I'd like to say in all of my time, one of the things that I'm most proud of being associated with our investment organization and the pension plans is that I've seen no political interference with regard to the entire operation. It's we've been nonpartisan. Our board and pretty much all the entire time I've been there, I've seen them act in a very bipartisan way, and I think that we. Have been a model for other organizations.
Okay. Seeing no additional questions, I will just thank you, Mr. Perry. Appreciate
thank
your
you.
Time. We'll, I guess, end this portion of our hearing. Certainly don't need to stay until 11:15 if we don't have to. I do, before we adjourn, I do want to call your attention to a memo that's included in the in your agenda packets. It's just describing a few bills being referred to the subcommittees, House Files 45, 40, and 94 being referred to the Elections Subcommittee, House Files 191 and 192 are being referred to the Local Government Subcommittee. Do, are there any questions from members? Okay, seeing none, this meeting is adjourned.